The music teacher says it was consensual sex. His former students say it was rape.
He had sex with me once in the classroom, in a closet.
Something happened to me too.
I thought he was our little predator.
Why wasn't he stopped? These women seek answers and justice. I'm Julie Ireton, host of a new podcast, The Banned Teacher. It's available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just that somebody could be this diabolical.
This is a CBC podcast.
On the morning of Sunday, April 19th, 2020, Heather O'Brien left her home to get some coffee for her daughters. Along the way, she pulled over to make a phone call to a friend. A man in a replica RCMP cruiser pulled up beside her Volkswagen Jetta and shot her. Heather was one of 22 people killed during a 13-hour rampage in and around Portapique, Nova Scotia. Heather O'Brien's daughter is Darcy Dobson, and I sat down with her minutes after the report from a public inquiry into this tragedy was released in a hotel in Truro, about an hour north of Halifax. Michael Scott joined us. He's a lawyer representing Darcy, along with a number of others who lost family members.
Hello to you both.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah?
Relatively, yes.
Tell me about the relatively. This has been a day, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's definitely an emotional day, but I was pleasantly surprised by some of the things that were said in the report, so I'm relatively good right now.
At the beginning of the report, there is a tribute to the people who were lost in this incident, and you wrote about your mom.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about who she was? You describe her as somebody who made a home that was a safe space for young people, that she was defined by her kindness. Tell me a bit about her.
My mom was a very kind person. She would give you the shirt off her back. She loved kids. She had a pile of them. So it goes without saying that everybody just felt safe around her. She was like a safe place to land. So it's a different world without her in it, especially like for the next generation that is her grandchildren.
And it sounded like she really, like she lived life kind of at maximum, right? She'd love playing crib at the Legion and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. She definitely did. She was certainly a very content person. She was very happy.
And deeply involved with the community as well.
As a VON nurse, she ended up going back to work in the community that she grew up in. So it was kind of a beautiful thing in a way, because people who watched her grow up, she got to help them through their retirement years, which is that has its own beauty in itself.
This has been a long road to get to today. And I just wonder, what were you hoping to see?
I think my hope was realistic recommendations that could be implemented. And I think we did get there to a certain point. I will say I was pleasantly surprised by what the commissioners did, especially when a lot of the time it felt like they weren't listening. So it was kind of nice to open the report and be like, okay, like maybe they did listen to some things.
I was downstairs when the release of the report was done, and there were a number of people from the community who walked out and in very strong language felt as though they had been ignored, that they hadn't been listened to. And they said that as they were walking out. Was that the sense from a lot of people, is that the commissioners and the commission wasn't listening?
Oh, absolutely. Especially like for family members and those most affected, there were certainly times that you knew you weren't being listened to or you were being blatantly ignored.
Can you give me an example of that?
I just think when it came to RCMP witnesses, especially, there was no cross-examination, and the commission would have you believe that there was this collaboration between participant and participant counsel, and they took the questions back and then they made a decision on what they were going to ask. And a lot of the times things weren't asked that were from our point of view. So it really did feel like we were almost like a pest to them. And I mean, the whole reason that the commission ever sat is because we fought for it.
Yeah.
So to be kind of treated like you're not being listened to is, it's a different way to feel, definitely.
You felt like you were a pest?
Yeah,
them.
Yeah,
that's
certainly.
That's an amazing way to characterize that. I mean, this was, as you said, because you fought for this, but it's also because of what happened to your family.
Right. Yep.
How do you understand that they would think of you as a pest? Where do you think that was coming from? Why would the commission have that perspective?
What they did was they were like, this is what we want to do. We want to have this trauma-informed. And I say that because it was not trauma-informed.
You were doing kind of like quotations,
yes. Yeah. This trauma-informed committee of people who sit down and only tell you what you want to hear, when the truth is all we needed were answers. And I mean, everybody saw the public proceedings, that the trauma-informed was meant to protect the RCMP officers.
And that's what you felt happened,
yes.
That the RCMP officers were protected.
Right, right. And we were not.
Mike, you've been listening to this. From your perspective, as you saw this unfold, what were you most concerned about going into this process? A process that had to be fought for. I mean, initially this inquiry wasn't going to happen, and it was family members and members of the community that fought for it. What were you most concerned about going into this?
I think what we were most concerned about was that the commission was going to try to follow a process that we thought was deeply misguided. So as we were getting ready to start the commission, we had far more questions than we should have had. And to some extent, our concerns materialized through public proceedings because we did have serious issues with the process that was chosen. You know, if the Marshall Inquiry is the gold standard of what a public inquiry should be, then the Mass Casualty Commission is, you know, a perfect example of how not to do a public inquiry.
What went wrong?
You know, there's clearly two very different philosophical ideas on what an inquiry is. And from our perspective, which has been the more traditional approach, it's a fact-finding process. It's an investigation out loud, and that requires transparency and candor and honesty. And we got the sense we were being resisted. There was a no-surprise environment in terms of public testimony. There were obvious questions that weren't followed up on.
Do you feel that the RCMP, as Darcy is saying, were being protected in some ways, and through the way that members of the force were testifying and the lack of the cross-examination that some people would be looking for?
Certainly from the outside, it appeared not so much that the commission was intentionally protecting RCMP officers, but that the RCMP was availing itself of the MCC's processes. Because if you notice, none of the witnesses from the participants ever required any sort of accommodation. They were all willing to, no matter how difficult it was, to testify, to come forward. And it would be upsetting and it would be difficult, but they would do it. You know, but to some extent, the RCMP was able to avail themselves of a process that, you know, that the MCC made available to them.
Darcy, what did you learn from this report as it came in? And again, it's very fresh, I know, and it's 3,000 pages. So there's still a lot, I'm sure, to go through if you want to do that. But what did you learn?
I think what I learned is how not to do a public inquiry. But I think as the recommendations came out and we looked at things, I was almost hopeful with the way that they have so many recommendations for policing in this province and federally.
Tell me more about that. I mean, in talking with people who live in the communities, that they've lost the sense of trust in police, and it's really hard to gain that back. When you look at the recommendations, what stands out to you about how that trust, perhaps if those recommendations were implemented, could be gained?
That is definitely going to be a process, especially in the small communities that we live in, like to regain the trust, because it's certainly lost. There's will never be a moment in my life that I see an RCMP cruiser go down the road and shivers don't go down my spine, which is unfortunate because there is a mistrust there. But the truth of it is the RCMP have done nothing to regain that. They don't see an issue. So for the final report to come out and highlight the issues that are there is great, because it gives us a talking point. It gives us a start to say, well, here we gathered all the facts. There is an issue here. Let's talk about it. And at least it starts a conversation and hopefully some sort of implementation going forward.
What could the police do to regain your trust?
I don't have an answer for that sitting here in front of you today. I think that's something I will have to think on. I'm going to have to finish reading the report. And really, that's something I have to decide within myself, I think, within my family and my community. And I can't answer that and stand completely behind my answer today.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart. And for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike, this is interesting because from the beginning, the commission said it wouldn't lay blame. But if you read that report, it's scathing when it comes to police and police missteps from the very beginning until long after those 13 hours. What stands out to you about that?
I think Darcy's entirely correct that part of the frustration for all of us has been if the RCMP cannot acknowledge that something has gone wrong, how can we be expected to trust that it will get better? I mean, obviously the very first part of making change is, you know, for everyone to have an acknowledgement that that this didn't work or that this was a mistake or that this needs to change.
But a lot of it is, I mean, failures of what seem to be basic policing, right?
I think it's reflected in the report on specifically the volume dealing with policing, that when you see a long list of those things that seem so obvious, there's a note in the report that says that the RCMP Code of Conduct should now include a provision that prohibits officers ingesting alcohol while working. Now, that would normally strike us as being something that doesn't require a multi-million dollar public inquiry for. But anytime we start to see these really basic things stacked up, I'd suggest that what that points to is not a series of individual problems, but of a management and a culture problem.
Part of this, to Darcy's point, is acknowledging, and you've said this as well, acknowledging that mistakes were made by the force. That would go some way to starting perhaps a process of regaining trust. But what else has to be done to make sure that people like Darcy's, I mean, that was incredible the way that you said it, that you would not be able to see an RCMP car go down the road past you without having a shiver.
Well, trust is earned. We've seen throughout this idea that, well, what can we say or what symbolic gesture can we make to regain your trust? And it overlooks that if you want, you know, Darcy's trust or someone else's trust, it's earned. It's a slow, hard process. It doesn't take very long to lose that trust, and it takes a long time to build it up. But there has to be some level of accountability.
You may not be able to say what it would take to earn your trust back, but are you at all confident that that's going to happen at some point in time? That the force would take the steps required to get someone like yourself on side?
I would like to hope that the force is open to saying, okay, we need to dismantle this and work on it from the ground up. From where I sit today, I have to say no, just because I don't think they understand the magnitude of the issue. Like it starts at the very top and just it works its way all the way down to your men on the ground who and women on the ground who are, if they don't have the right leadership, they cannot go out and police in communities that don't trust them.
Mm. I mean, and this leads into the other issue of trauma and the kind of trauma that exists in a moment like that, but also exists long after a moment, in the years following that. We spoke with a grief counselor yesterday who talked about how trauma begets trauma in many ways. And what happens if it's not addressed is that other things can unfold in the wake of a tragedy like this. There has been a lot of talk about the fact that people in your community and people like yourself perhaps didn't get the support that was required in the wake of what happened 3 years ago. How would you characterize that? Have you received the support that you and your community think you need?
I think the short answer is no. I come from a really large family that's very close, so we support each other. But Nova Scotia didn't know what it was dealing with. So there wasn't anybody who had ever dealt with anything like this. So you look at the supports that they brought in, but it wasn't enough. There wasn't enough. I know I have a few sisters who struggled over getting therapy, working through victim services, taking time off work. I have one sister that worked for the Nova Scotia Health Authority who for mental health and wellness who couldn't take time off work, which is...
What do you mean? Sorry. She in the wake of this...
Right.
Couldn't take time off work,
right?
Despite the fact that she works in mental health and social services.
Right. So like there's systematic issues that need to be fixed within the government to make sure that people who go through something like that this have the support that they need.
How were you treated in the wake of this?
I was sheltered by my community. I will say my community and the people around me and my family. I think the way we were treated by the RCMP was miserable. Like, you're taught from the time that you're a child to trust the police officer on the corner, right? Like, he's the good guy. He's going to save the day. And the way that they treated us afterwards was gross, honestly. I am very grateful for my community. I'm very grateful for my family, because without them, I would not have made it through this.
I'm really cautious about asking about this, but you use the word gross in particular. And I know there's specific things that refers to. Do you mind talking about that?
I'm not going to. I'm not going to put myself in that kind of a position. I've come a long way in 3 years, and I've worked really hard to be sitting where I am today to have this conversation with you.
What does it say to you that in the wake of a tragedy like this, at this scale, that people like yourself weren't given the appropriate care, weren't given the care that not you deserve, but the care that you needed?
It's been nearly 3 years. We can't change what happened. There's no changing it, but there is this opportunity to change it for the next person. So let's take it. Let's take the opportunity. Let's look at what we did wrong. Let's take accountability for our actions and fix it for the next person that sits here. And I hope to God there never is another person that has to sit here. Let's hold ourselves accountable and do better.
There's a recommendation that's in this report that a body be established to help ensure that the changes that have been recommended actually get made. And there's a group of people who have lived experience in this moment who push for that. Is that something that you'd, in this moment, that you'd consider being part of?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you answered the question almost before I was finished.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's very important. And I think this whole exercise is pointless without the implementation, right? It all looks good on paper, looks great. But if we can't implement the recommendations that are made, like many inquiries before us, there is no implementation. Nobody actually takes the time to create the body, to have the hard conversation, to make the change. And I would absolutely sit in that body of people and have that conversation and do whatever I need it to make these changes, because it's important.
Mike, what will it take to make sure that this isn't, as the commissioner said, another report?
The reality is it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort. It's going to take people like Darcy, who will unfailingly continue to push the issue for years to come. It's going to take a great deal of political capital. The reason why we see these issues in public inquiries and the implementation part is because it's a tremendous amount of work to get it from the recommendation stage to the implementation stage.
In speaking with somebody yesterday, they said that the community in some ways had its identity change. And I just wonder what you see in your community now. How do you see the community now?
I think that's a fair way to put it. But at the end of the day, the same people are in that community, and people are what make a community. And I would like to say that my community is stronger than it's ever been, because we learned to band together to go through the hard stuff. So I believe it will always be different. There will always be a before and after. I think it's as strong as it's ever been because of the people who make up my community.
And so what happens now? I mean, the story of a community and the story of a family and your story, it's like a book, and there's chapters in the book, and this is one of those chapters, right? But it's not the end of the book in some ways. How do you see this? Do you see this as a moment that lets you start to move in a different direction, or?
Yeah, absolutely. It gives you the chance to kind of branch off. I don't see this really as an end, like it's the end of the inquiry, but it is the beginning of something big. And that's the way I would like to look at it, because this is the beginning of the hard conversations. This is the beginning of, let's get this implemented. Let's make changes. Let's make all in the name of these beautiful lives that are gone, right? So this is, for me, this is where my work starts. And I'm really looking forward to it, actually.
And that thing, the memory that you wrote about your mom at the beginning of the report, there was this lovely line at the end in which she said that she believed in the good that's left in this world.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
What does that mean to you, having gone through what you and your family have gone through? It's hard to find good in the world sometimes.
It really is. The world is definitely a different place for me. I view it differently, but I do believe in the good that's left in this world. I believe that there is a lot of good people with wonderful ideas and that bring so much good. Like there is so much good left in the world. And the second you lose sight of that, that's where the problem starts.
Where do you see it? Where do you see that good?
I see that good in my father, my siblings, my beautiful children. I see that good all around me. The legacy that was left to me by my mother is a beautiful thing.
I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you. And I'm really glad today's been a really hard day, I'm sure, in a long list of hard days, but that you'd be willing to take the time to speak with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Darcy Dobson's mother, Heather O'Brien, was killed in the rampage in Portapique in 2020. Michael Scott is her lawyer. He also represents others who lost loved ones.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.